Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and today my guest is Brett Simmons, who you may remember was previously on the show on episode 10. He is the director of You Might Be the Killer, a film that we could not talk about when I previously interviewed on that episode, as it was in post at the time and was just about to have its premiere. But we talked about a variety of other things on that episode. And if you have a look at that episode, there's a lot of great stuff there. We talk about some of his other movies. We talk about how he got into horror, his influences, a whole bunch of things. But in this episode, we talk mainly about You Might Be the Killer. We go into various different facets of the film, how the film came about through a Twitter thread, the writing of the film, the casting of the film. You know, we really dive deep into a bunch of topics so you can learn all about the movie, and then you can go and watch the movie. Good times. Yeah, apart from that, I mean, there's some entertaining diversions as well. We end up randomly talking about killer clowns from outer space. Not a topic I thought I would pop up during the interview, but it did. Anyway, I will not spoil the interview for you anymore and just hand you straight over to my guest, Brett Simmons.
Hi Brett, welcome back on New Horror Express for your second appearance. The first person to have a second appearance on the show.
Sweet, that's an honor. I'm back. I wanted to try and say I'm back in like the sweet little poltergeist voice, but I just realized that's just going to really come across weird at the head of a podcast to hear a grown man imitating a girl voice. So I didn't, but I am back. Yes.
Well, it still would have been fun. It still would have been an entertaining way to open this episode.
Yeah, like, oh man, what is up with this dude, Brett?
Well, you know, I mean, like, hopefully people have checked the first interview out already and, you know, are ready for part two and more wackiness, you know? Like,
they're like, oh yeah, we know exactly what's up with this weirdo. That's funny. No, I'm stoked to be back, man. Thanks for having me. That was a lot of fun last time. Last time we talked a lot of Ghostbusters, which was amazing.
We did talk a lot of Ghostbusters.
Oh, man, I could talk about Ghostbusters for days.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, we're going to get into your movie in just a second. But, yeah, the last time we talked a lot about how, you know, Ghostbusters, and we talked a lot about how there's not really kind of horror for kids. There was in the 80s, and there's not now. Since we recorded back in July, there's been Goosebumps 2, there's been The House with the Clocks on the Wall, and there's been The Summer of 84. So that has just totally shot down the argument I made in the previous interview.
It is kind of exciting though. Like, it's good to see more popping up, you know, like, because I do feel the same way that I felt when we talked. I just feel like there's not enough of it, but it's fun to see it popping up more. You know, it's like you have the House of the Clocks and the Walls, like directed by Eli Roth. You know, it's like just like straight up rated R graphic horror director making something spooky for kids, which is kind of cool. Like my son, he's a 10, he's almost 11, and he definitely has like an appetite for like kind of like scary movies and spooky movies. I don't let him watch any, but he wants to see them so bad. And he was like really into the House of Clocks as well. We actually watched the original Goosebumps And I love watching that one. I haven't seen the second one. I actually don't know. I don't know if I can bring myself to watch it, but it feels very, trying to figure out how to say, it doesn't feel like it's on the same level as the first one. That's what I'll say. But I actually was surprised by the first Goosebumps movie. I really liked it a lot.
I think it took a lot of people by surprise. But I have the same feeling about the second one of, like, the first one kind of brought back all the stuff from the kind of classic Goosebumps novels.
Yeah.
And then, so you kind of don't know where they go from there. And the only thing they go from there is kind of like their own thing, which might not be as good.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny is since we last talked too, I saw a movie that was famously made as a horror movie for kids that was never even on my radar in that genre, and I watched it, and I actually couldn't believe how long it had taken me to see it. And I've since seen it multiple times, not by my own choosing, but because it's just all of a sudden kind of entered into my atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Have you seen that?
Clowns. Yeah, I have seen Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
It is a weird movie.
It is a very strange... I mean, it's a very entertaining film. It's a while since I've seen it, but it is a strange, strange movie.
Really, really bizarre. But what was interesting about it was I saw it... So, I mean, and I know we'll get into it, but...
Yeah.
You Might Be the Killer has been playing at a bunch of really great festivals. And one of the festivals it played at hosted a 30th anniversary screening of Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that'd be really kind of cool to go. It was in a massive theater. So I was like, it'd be cool to go see this movie with an audience. You know, I just feel like, you know, you see movies with a crowd, they're totally different than when you're just sitting at home watching them by yourself. So I went, and Stephen Chiodo, the original director, he and his brothers like made the movie and all the clowns and everything. Yeah. And he was there. So I watched the movie with a crowd, which was a really like educational experience and definitely elevated the experience of watching a very weird movie. But then he was there, and it was interesting to hear him talk about it, because he was talking about how their whole MO was, they call them candy-coated kills. Mm-hmm. And they wanted all the kills to have an air of a candy coating, you know, like be a little bit fun, be a little bit wacky, but still scary, because they very much wanted the movie to be like kind of like a quote unquote baby's first horror movie, you know, like like horror movie for kids. And so it was really funny, like on the heels of like everything we talked about last time, you know, and it very much is a thing that is constantly on my mind. It was really informative watching that, and so it was really cool. I actually got to take so I was at this festival with You Might Be the Killer, and which I just now realized we can actually talk about, because last time I couldn't really talk about the movie too much, like I was still finishing it. So I was like half talking about it, but like elusively talking about it, where now I can say whatever you want me to say about it. But anyways, last bit of the side note, I had to take a shuttle ride down the mountain from Telluride back to the airport to get home when the festival was done, and I was on a shuttle with the director, Stephen Chiodo. And it's like a 2-hour shuttle ride. And so he was a really sweet guy, and he saw that I was a filmmaker and wanted to talk to me about my movie. And I was like, why are we talking about my movie? Let's talk about your movie. And I just talked to him for the whole ride about Killer Clowns. I got way more information about Killer Clowns than I think I ever really needed, but it was awesome.
That sounds great. I feel like I should go back and rewatch Killer Clowns, because I remember it being a lot of fun, and it's quite a while since I've
well, here's a funny question. Like when actually is the, how old do you think you were the last time you watched that movie?
I would say, well, I'm 33 now. I would say like in my early 20s or something, like quite a long time ago.
Okay, gotcha. What's funny is after I saw it, I just started pulling my friends, just like, hey, have you seen Killer Clowns? Everyone unanimously, like all of them had seen it, and all of them loved it. But then all of them hadn't seen it in at least 20 years, which was so funny to me. I was like, so all of you see this, all of you love it, but none of you have even watched this movie in the last 20 years. So I'd be really curious to know what you think, because that's what I asked all them. I was like, go back and rewatch it. I'd love to know what you think, because I'm seeing it for the first time as a 36-year-old, and I'm like, I could see the appeal, but there's some really weird stuff.
Yeah, well, I'll definitely get back to you when I rewatch. I know I definitely plan to rewatch Killer Clowns.
It's worth it. It's fun. It was definitely fun. But yeah, all that's to say is kids horror, it's coming back.
It's back now. We can say that we started it. Can we say that?
I
don't know.
I was not going to be that bold, but I feel like together we can. Yeah, it's our. We brought it back. Eli Roth didn't even start making his movie until he heard our podcast.
He made it very quickly.
I mean, he was like, "We got to get this thing out in like 3 weeks."
Exactly. So, that was a fun sidebar there, but I feel like we probably should talk about You Might Be the Killer, because it is your latest movie, and it has been at various festivals. First of all, let's talk about how the movie came about. I mean, the movie was inspired by a Twitter conversation between two writers, Chuck Wendig and Sam Sykes. How did you first hear about this? Were you part of that Twitter thing? Apparently it drew in something like 11,000 followers in. Were you aware of it at the time, or was it something you just heard about later?
So it was, I was not aware of the Twitter conversation at any point until I got a call from the producers about it. The producers of the movie, I should say, it was really the one of the producers and an executive who was on board with the movie. They're people that I've worked with before who basically optioned the rights to the Twitter conversation. Mm-hmm. And they knew they wanted to adapt it into a movie. They had a loose idea of how, but they were looking for someone to come in and actually do the adaptation and then direct it. Like they were looking for a writer director, and they just felt like it was up my alley, which it 100% was. Like they knew me well enough to know that that was 100% true. Like as soon as I heard the premise, I was really into it. But that took a minute, because the call that I got initially was, "Hey, how do you feel about adapting a Twitter conversation into a movie?" And I was just kind of like, "Oh my gosh! Like how far have we dropped? Like how low have we gotten as an industry that we're having to tap Twitter for the horror movie ideas?" But the conversation, it was just nowhere on my radar, which is why I had a really mixed reaction. But then once I read the conversation that they were talking about, I was like, okay, this is actually really funny. And I did feel like reading the conversation that there were very natural story beats that could be structured out as far as like pacing and timing. And you could actually I felt like you could actually tell a story with it. Was the other thing. So I had a little bit of a really odd knee-jerk reaction to the concept of Twitter at first, but then the content was great. The writers, Chuck and Sam, they're hilarious. And the producers, because I already have a relationship with them, were just very excited to just dive in and have a lot of fun with it. And so that's kind of like how I got on board with it. I co-wrote it with Tom Vitale, who's one of the producers, and then we just had a lot of fun like just adapting it. You know, I mean, the main thing for me was that I don't know if anyone, and if anyone listening has not read this Twitter conversation, I highly recommend it if you're a horror fan. It's really funny. Like, just look up Chuck Wendig, Sam Sykes horror Twitter, and you'll find it. You might find it sooner than all those words I told you to Google, but it's really, really funny. And my big thing was, I was like, I want every line of dialogue in this conversation to actually be in the movie. Yeah. The main challenge was having to figure out all the additional dialogue they're going to need to have in order to actually fill a movie.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, that was one of the other things I was going to ask was, you know, this is just a Twitter conversation. So how difficult was that to flesh that out in a screenplay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was hard. I think it was just tricky because I'm definitely going to get into spoilers. So if anyone hasn't seen the movie, spoilers ahead, so beware. But the Twitter conversation, which itself does spoil the movie. So I guess if you've read the Twitter conversation, the movie's already spoiled.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I always recommend see the movie, then read the Twitter conversation, and then you can listen to all the interviews and stuff. But the Twitter conversation, have you read it, Scott? Have you read it?
I've not read the full thing, no.
Well, you should check it out. So what's interesting is the Twitter conversation kind of breaks down into these pieces of, did you see the movie yet? Because I'm about to spoil the movie for you.
Unfortunately, there's not been
it's
a
screening. It's hard to watch right now.
What?
It's hard to find to watch right now. So no hard feelings. I totally get it.
Yeah, no, I definitely want to check it out. It's just there's not been a screening this side of the pond near me. I know there was you were saying earlier it was a surprise movie at Celluloid Screams down in Sheffield.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was a surprise movie there. It's about to get released, so you won't have to wait long.
I should say for the listeners, that was previously in the off-air conversation.
Yeah. In the off-air conversation. Well, all that's to say is, yeah, it's had a bunch of festival screenings, and it's aired on the Sci-Fi Channel a few times, but I know that that has been domestic here in the U.S. I don't know how much of that has, like, gone over the pond or not. But it is about to get a wide release, like, all over, so everyone will be able to see it. But because of that, I'll keep it spoiler-free. What it is the conversation on Twitter unfolds in different phases where there's a little bit of a dilemma that Sam is going through, that Chuck is helping him out. And then Chuck, just by means of deduction and questioning Sam, figures out a very key piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And then that starts to inform the struggle from that point on. And then as that's unfolding, Chuck starts to deduce another key conflict for Sam that he's going to have to deal with. And all of this unfolds really quickly. It's only like a 60-some-odd tweet long conversation.
Oh.
But I just kind of looked at it like, okay, so this key piece of information that Chuck deduces, that should be our act break. Like, Chuck shouldn't figure that out until the end of Act 1. Which meant, okay, so now I know the whole first act needs to be characterized by this dilemma. So the conversation lasts for maybe like 2 minutes worth of that. Where else can that dilemma go, and how far can that dilemma go before we reveal this piece of information? Was kind of my task. And then once we reveal that piece of information, I knew the next big hurdle is going to be this conflict that Chuck figures out. So how long can we deal with this initial hurdle before we introduce the second hurdle, and what transpires there, and where does the conversation go from there? So it's almost like the Twitter conversation initiated conflicts and initiated tone and dialogue that I had to extend and adapt further. But it was really fun because, and again, like, without knowing how much anyone is even aware of the Twitter conversation, the gist of it is that Sam is basically a guy trapped at a summer camp and a serial killer is broken loose. And he's tweeting his friend Chuck. He's live tweeting his friend Chuck, just, hey man, wonder if you can help me out. There's a killer on the loose. I'm pretty sure I'm going to die. And Chuck like, okay. So who's dead so far? Okay. Well, I'm not really sure exactly how many did it, but I think there are a lot of people dead, you know, and it's just kind of a dialogue back and forth. Like,
yeah,
almost like you're calling like your buddy trying to help you escape a horror movie. Right. Which is really funny, but what it introduces, the reason I bring it up is because you have one person who's panicking inside a horror movie, and then you have the other person who's pretty objectively safe, who's like a book of knowledge of horror movies, kind of trying to give like objective opinions and advice, right?
Yeah.
And what was funny about it was, since I was co-writing it with Tom Vitale's a little older than me, and he's been at this a lot longer than me. And so he has a wide breadth of knowledge of the genre.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do too, but his is like far more in depth. And so he and I, when we'd be writing, we'd almost kind of default into these role-playing games, kind of like an improv exercise where I was by default Sam, who's kind of younger and more anxious, And then he was turning into Chuck, kind of like the wiser, calmer voice. And we would sit there like, okay, well, if Sam's trapped here and you're there, and it's almost like we'd start to just live improvise this conversation that would just start cracking us up and we'd have to start dictating. But what was nice was it all felt very much in the voice of Chuck and Sam, who we would then be able to send scenes to, and they'd be able to like tweak lines and dialogue. You know, it's like, oh, we should say it more like this or this.
Right.
So it was actually really fun. It was like a really fun process. It was cool.
Yeah. Was it a bit different? Because I've noticed that in your previous credits, you've generally written stuff yourself. So how was the process of having a co-writer and working on a script with somebody else?
You know, it was actually really smooth. I mean, our deadline was really crazy, so we didn't really have time to wrestle with it. We didn't really have an option to wrestle with it. Like, we just had to make it work. But because the movie is about these two characters in this crazy situation, having a co-writer actually really helped in the sense of everything that I was just discussing, you know, about like us being able to kind of inhabit each of these roles. And that really, I think, added a lot to the script as far as just combining our brains. So it actually was way more fluid than I ever expected it to be. You're right. I haven't like blatantly co-written with a lot of people. I do have a writing partner that I crack story with a lot. Like, he and I really brainstorm story and crack structure and story together. And then I go off and do the screenplay. And that process is fun because it's like, you know, you have this blank slate and then you can combine brains and just throw clay at the wall and just try and mold something. And then once you got it, you're now at the task of the details, but that job is easy when everything else has been figured out. But I've never actually like in tandem had to like write with somebody else until this one. And it was pretty cool. What was hard about was Tom is in New York and I'm in California. And we never were in the same room for it. So the whole movie, Sam and Chuck are never in the same room because Sam's trapped at this camp and Chuck is in this comic store that she runs. So they're only ever on the phone together. And it actually was really funny because that was there before we had to start writing. That was in the Twitter conversation. And it ended up being exactly the same in the writing process because Tom and I could never be in the same room together. So we were always on the phone with each other. Trying to make a movie about two people that were always on the phone with each other. So it was really funny in that way. But that was probably the biggest challenge, was just not being in the same room and being on different coasts.
That must be quite a challenging thing.
It was weird. But I write in this, I mean, I'm sure everyone's like, uses it, but there's a screenwriting software called Final Draft that is awesome, and they have this collaborate feature on there on the newest version of it, the Final Draft 10, the newest version. It has a collaboration feature, which I've never really had to use, that Tom and I implemented, and actually was a lifesaver for anyone who's like using Final Draft and like curious about it. I was really grateful to figure this out, and so I was like, man, I need to just pass on this knowledge to as many people as possible. But the whole gist of it is, like, when I open the script, I can turn on this mode called collaboration, and it kind of creates an FTP that people can log into, and basically everyone from wherever they are in the world can be on the same script. And so I would invite Tom to it, or if he was on, he'd invite me to it, and I could literally hand the page over to him digitally and watch him live retyping dialogue. They go, I have an idea for a line, let me see. And I would just take my hands off the keyboard and he would write it. And I'd see the whole thing materializing right there on the page. And go, what do you think about that? And then I could live cross out this word, cross out that word, and go, I feel like that would make it work better. And he goes, yeah, that's great. And then we just adjust it. And so it was like we were both in the same room digitally. Oh. It was the craziest thing. It was actually really, really helpful, a major lifesaver. So anyone who's curious about that, Final Draft, like, really hooked it up.
Excellent. For any budding screenwriters listening to this, Final Draft, that's the software.
Final Draft, do it. It's awesome. It's worth every penny.
As Sam and Chuck are both writers themselves and are also producers on the film, did they want to muck about with the script that you've been working on, or like how much input did they want to have, or did you have to rebuff them at all?
We invited them to be a part of as much as possible. They, because they're writers, before I was ever even called, I know the producers had had conversations with them about writing it. Mm-hmm. And I think that they would have been way more interested in writing it if our deadline wasn't so rushed. We basically, our movie got greenlit in January of this year without a script. And then all the deals weren't done and everything until like March. Uh-huh. And so, and we were going into production in like May. And so March came along and we still didn't have a script. And so it had to be written really quickly in order to be ready to shoot when we needed to shoot it. It was greenlit, basically it was financed and greenlit based on being ready for the fall this year. Was like, that was like the, that was the only like date contingent part of the contract. Right. And so that was the reason why was the turnaround on it was really fast. So I feel like if, and no writer like really wants to be under that kind of pressure. So I feel like if Sam and Chuck hadn't been, I should say, I feel like if we didn't have the deadline and Sam and Chuck had an actual like breadth of time to kind of get into it and have some fun with it. Cause they're both novel writers. They both write novels and like comic books and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I think it's definitely, they're like unbelievable writers. I think it was more just kind of a hesitancy with just screenplay structure and just having to learn what it is to like figure that out when there's no time to do that. So pretty early out the gate, my understanding is that really early out the gate, they basically were like, no, like we don't want to write the movie. We would want to write the movie, but it doesn't sound like this is the right opportunity for us to be doing that. So they automatically just kind of waived all screenplay responsibilities to whoever the producers were going to find. But they were, you know, very open to being involved and excited to be involved. And so it was important to me and to Tom to kind of keep the door open to them and like just keep them invited to participate on whatever level they were comfortable. We would finish drafts of it and then send it to them and get their feedback. And they would have some story feedback, you know, like this would be really cool. This scene feels a little hard or illogical or da 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 da. But it was really a nice collaborative process because they also didn't want to get in the way, right? So they were like, and we feel like we have an opportunity to be a part, but we also aren't really screenwriters. So we defer to you guys. If you're looking for notes and you agree with this note, this is how this made me feel, but do what you think is best, which was really nice of them and like really generous of them. And I took so much of their feedback to heart and put in the script. The majority of the feedback that we got that was just so helpful was just them holding Tom and I accountable to making sure that the voices of Sam and Chuck still sounded like Sam and Chuck, which was really nice. So I feel like at the end of the day, when you see it, like the Sam and Chuck in the movie do very much represent and have the seal of approval of actual Sam and Chuck.
It seems very in keeping with the meta-ness of the, having seen the kind of trailers and clips, it seems very in keeping with the meta-ness of the movie for the actual characters to still be called Sam and Chuck.
Yeah, it's it definitely kept things easy, just calling them Sam and Chuck. And I hope that it would harken back to the Twitter conversation too. So like anyone who saw the movie that didn't realize it was based off of it would be like, wait a second, I feel like I've heard this before. The one thing we did that really changed it up that I thought was kind of fun and exciting and real life Chuck was totally cool, that was we made a movie Chuck. We swapped gender. So
yeah,
Chuck in the movie is actually a female, Allison Hannigan.
So did you write it like that? It was that in the script. It wasn't that you were looking for people and then cast Allison Hannigan and then it became female. It was female from the screenplay.
Yeah. So basically, as soon as we started the screenplay, we wrote Chuck as a female. And really, all that really meant was just her descriptions and some of her scripted actions and mannerisms. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't feel like it necessarily changed her voice a whole lot. Because then once Allison came on set, you know, Allison had all kinds of ideas of just like character subtext and things. Like her issues with Sam's ex-girlfriend is in the movie, and so Chuck actually has a few criticisms with her, and Allison really blurred the line of, are these criticisms as a friend or are these criticisms because Chuck kind of harbors feelings for Sam, you know, stuff that only exists when the two of them are kind of, you know, this guy girl best buddy relationship. Just some nice little subtext stuff that was not scripted. That was all just an Allison's performance, but wouldn't have existed. But what was funny was making Chuck a woman didn't really change Chuck's voice a whole lot. And then we did write a draft. I was tasked with taking one of our final drafts and turning Chuck's role into a guy, because while we were waiting on Allison, like, we had brainstormed a few ideas. We never really got to go all the way down this road, but we had brainstormed a few ideas of guys that we would go after if Allison wasn't interested, just to be safe. Mm-hmm. And so we did have a version of the script that rewrote Chuck's voice to be way more of a guy voice. And that actually changed it more than initially writing it for a female character. So I don't know what that says about my writing, that Chuck's voice, Chuck as a guy, his voice worked perfectly for Allison. And then when I needed it to be a guy, I like changed it even more. I added a bunch of dudes and a couple fart jokes, but fortunately we never went down that road. I was always really excited for Chuck to be a really like a cool, strong, like smart female character.
Excellent. So the central characters are played by Franz Kahns and Allison Hannigan. Were those the kind of people in mind, or how did they come on board into the film?
Well, they were definitely like the types in mind, like Chuck being very smart and knowledgeable. Allison's name came up like right away, just based off of a lot of her work on Buffy and everything. And the other thing is that Chuck, for me, like Chuck, Sam in the movie, and you guys will know when you watch the movie, but the movie starts very quickly, and you set up Sam being stuck in a very dire situation right away within the first like 5 seconds of the movie. And so I felt like his stakes were clear, which meant that his introduction was clear. And then he calls Chuck, and we just have to be on board right away with Chuck being his buddy and someone we can trust.
Yeah.
So it was really important to me that Chuck was also played by someone who just was immediately likable and trustworthy, which Allison really captured for me. You know, I didn't want to introduce a character that had any suspicions about her. And so that really brought Allison's name to the forefront very early on. And then Fran, I've been a big fan of Fran for a long time, and I think he's really funny. But I also think he's just an incredible actor. And that was the big challenge with Sam, was just trying to find an actor who could be both, you know, hysterical in a dire sense and hysterical in a comedic sense, and kind of juggle both of those simultaneously. Because a lot of the movie is him running for his life, and sometimes that's scary and intense, and sometimes that's hilarious. And so how does someone do both honestly and not look like he's just acting in like a skit, you know? Yeah. And so Fran was kind of like my ideal for the movie, and I never thought we would get him. I never thought we'd get Allison either. Like, we made offers to them as actors that I was just really interested in, just kind of me thinking that we were swinging for the fences. And we got them, which was unbelievable. So I'm really proud of everything they did in it.
Given the fact the movie is quite meta, given the fact that Fran is one of the main stars and Allison is one of the main stars, were you worried about any comparisons to Joss Whedon's work, or particularly Cabin in the Woods?
Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't, because it's been really funny, because a lot of the reviews for the movie have been comparing it to like Scream and Cabin in the Woods, which is really flattering. Mm-hmm. But I never made those comparisons in my mind, because we're such a small movie. I was like, there's no way people are going to be compared. These aren't even in the same league as those movies. And by the way, our movie still is not anywhere in the same league as those movies. If anything, maybe we're lucky to be like the baby distant cousin of those movies. But no, I honestly never was, because we were such a small movie. And I also, like, I had never even, like, I remember we were on set and I realized, oh, wait a second, they're both really famous Joss Whedon alumni. And I hadn't even made that connection, just because they are so isolated from each other in the story, as far as never being in the same place, which meant that their locations when we were shooting the movie were very isolated from each other, and they never share any screen time, which means even the actors were really isolated from each other. You know, Fran was always in the woods, and Chuck was always in the comic shop, and we block shot her stuff all in 2 days. So it's almost like we left the camp where the horror was happening to go to this comic shop for 2 days to shoot her and then go back to the camp to finish shooting all of Fran's stuff. So they were constantly in pre-production and then in production, so isolated from each other. I wasn't even making any connections like that until way later down the road. I'm like, wait, oh, wow. Oh my God. I did think that because of Cabin in the Woods, I more just really trusted that Fran was going to be, you know, just everything I wanted for the role of Sam. But I also felt like the role was really different. Mm-hmm. I think the movie was really different, but yeah, I did, as we went on, just kind of started realizing, wow, we are both very meta movies. If anything, my only concern was that I did worry that I thought there was no way that Fran was going to come do our movie because of Cabin in the Woods. I thought, well, he's already gone down. He's checked this box and he's gone and he's done a really cool meta horror. I think the ultimate cool meta horror movie. I'm like, there's no way he'd want to do this, but man, he'd be so great. I guess let's just see what he says. And it turns out that Fran, he just loves horror movies and he loves horror comedies and he loves these types of movies. And he was so on board. I was actually really flattered. I was like, wow, like he's really stoked to be out here. And he actually became a good friend and like just collaborator, just because he and I have really similar taste and really similar sense of humor. And so, yeah, I thought never in a million years is he going to do this. And then he did, and I couldn't believe it. But yeah, no, I was never really worried about it. If anything, I try and tell people, hey, I'm really flattered by those comparisons, but don't make those comparisons. We're very different. We're much smaller.
So you didn't kind of watch any of that stuff. You didn't like kind of watch any other meta horrors, or just very much focused on their own film, you know, you might be the killer.
Well, I did. Well, see, because what it is that our movie is so much about a guy being trapped in the story, not in a like blatant meta way. He's a guy that's at a summer camp that's being attacked by a serial killer. Mm-hmm. And so he just by nature is like, I'm going to call my friend who watches stories about people trapped at camps with serial killers all the time to see what kind of hope and ideas I can glean. He does try and call the police first, but he's in the middle of nowhere and the police officer is old and probably sleeping. So it's not his first line of defense. His second line of defense is calling his buddy. And I felt because the movie hinged so much on these friends, what was really important to me, these two friends on the phone together, that it was always really important to me that their friendship was believable, but also that the stakes were real. That was something that Fran and I talked about really early on too, that it was just really important that the deaths were actually deaths and that Sam's responsibility was real and his guilt and the pressure on him, just all of that, all of his stakes were real, honest stakes, you know? Yeah. It needed to be genuinely life and death for him, because I thought it was going to be too cute if he was like, oh, here I am in this slasher movie, you know, like I needed him to be actually fearing for his life and for that to feel genuine and authentic, with a few winks here and there to the fact that real life is imitating art, you know? And so my focus was, I didn't rewatch Scream. I didn't rewatch Cabin in the Woods. I was revisiting all the camp slashers I had grown up watching. Like I revisited all the Friday the 13th and like Sleepaway Camp and Basket Case and stuff. And like was trying to revisit these movies more, just trying to glean just what are some of the repetitious beats.
Yeah.
That we can either repeat intentionally or avoid to kind of subvert expectations, you know. But I was more trying to research what is the situation that Sam is stuck in, so I can make sure his situation is dire and his stakes are real and that Chuck's actually helping him survive. Really more research, not for jokes, but research for just creating the horror of it, so that I just figured, I always hoped and expected that the humor was going to come out of treating all of that really seriously. So that was kind of where my mind was on it all.
Well, although some of the later ones of Friday the 13th become quite meta themselves.
Yeah, it's true. Like, is Friday the 13th 4 the one when like Corey Feldman like making all the masks and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah. They do. You're right.
Yeah, and then there's it's Friday the 13th Part 6, where Jason gets resurrected by a lightning bolt, and then they have like a James Bond style opening. That's really quite meta, that one.
Yep. They start to get. I feel like there's nowhere else to go.
Yeah, no,
you can't just keep repeating the movies so much, which is actually why I mainly revisited Friday the 13th 1, 2, and 3.
They're quite straight.
Yeah, because they're really straight, and I felt like this movie would be the really straight movie. If we did a sequel, that's when I'd have to revisit all like 4, 5, 6, Freddy vs. Jason, New Nightmare, you know, like all those like late 80s, 90s kind of meta iteration.
You don't have to revisit 5. 5 is terrible.
Oh, maybe I'll skip 5. It's really funny. Like, I have a real soft spot for the first Friday the 13th. I've always struggled with the fact that Jason's back and we never know why. Like, wait a second. Why is he a grown man now? Did he ever really die? How is he even back? But we're just supposed to go along with it. And I'm like, this is a franchise with a ton of movies. Arguably, after James Bond, one of the biggest franchises as far as additions. And it's all built on a really, really flimsy foundation.
Well, I've heard interviews with Sean S. Cunningham, the creator of Friday the 13th franchise, and even he admits that the first one was basically just a Halloween knockoff.
Well, you know what's funny? I know, like, I've listened to a few of his interviews, and like, John Carpenter, like, I've heard him talk about Halloween, and Ian Wes Craven is like, what's funny is this whole heyday of the slashers for us, people didn't go into making these low budget movies expecting franchises. Like, franchise is what surprised each of these filmmakers, you know? So like, you know, John Carpenter famously talks about how Halloween was only ever one movie. Yeah. And then he didn't even want to do the sequel. And when he did the sequel, the only idea he had was to just make the same night run longer and then end it a second time. Because, yeah, okay, well, now there's no more Halloweens, which is why he gets his eyes shot out and he gets burned. Like, no one was thinking about how to build these movies to go on. And, like, same with Friday the 13th. It was like Sean Cunningham, like, you know, the killer is Pamela Voorhees, which makes perfect sense. She gets her head chopped off. And then the whole gag of Jason coming out of the water was just a dream, but super scary. And that's it. Hope you have a great summer. It's like, we want more. It's like, I don't know how to do more. And so everyone's having to like kind of like scramble to figure out these sequels that they never planned for, built for. So it's really funny. Like, these franchises are huge, but they were never built from episode one to be episodes. It's really funny.
It is really funny. Friday the 13th a kind of funny movie, because I mean, like, when you see the kills happening, I mean, it's clearly, these people are clearly being killed by a 6-foot-tall 200-pound man, not a 60-year-old woman. But, you know, like, so that Scooby-Doo reveal is hilarious.
Yeah, it's kind of like, wait, what? I know, it's really funny. It's so true. And then when they reveal it as Jason in the second one, I think they're kind of going like, almost feel like the producers are like, I have this recurring image of certain producers like looking like Harry and Marv from Home Alone, just going like, kids are stupid. You know, where like they're just like, oh, well, it'll be Jason and kids won't care because kids are stupid. And instead, I feel like it's one big giant question mark where it's like, wow, it's cool as Jason, but how? Oh, well. Like, when I was young, I remember not caring. And now as an adult, I go back and revisit. And I'm like, this is like a big, massive, giant plot hole that I guess we're all just going to move on from.
Yeah, but we're just all, yeah, I'm the same. You know, you watched a lot of these movies and your teens and stuff, and you don't really think about that kind of stuff. And then you rewatch them and you're like, I guess we're all just going along with that. All good. More films. Yay.
Wow, you can make one of the most famous movies in the world and have a massive plot hole that everyone will just ignore. But it's funny because I feel like you get away with that stuff then because it was just all still burgeoning and kind of like in its infant stages, whereas now there's no way to get away with it, you know? Like, I even have thought about that, like, as far as, like, how to reboot Friday the 13th and, like, how do you rebuild the foundation there? And, like, saw the new Halloween, and I was really resistant to the fact that they omitted Halloween 2, but then, like, I also see the logic. You know, like, they're trying to bring back Michael in a way that makes sense for a 2018 audience. It's just really funny to see how the audience has changed. And I think about a lot of this because if we were to do a sequel to You Might Be the Killer, and I mean, I can't spoil it because you got to see the movie, but the idea of lightning striking and Jason coming back like every 2 years is something that Chuck very much brings up in the Twitter conversation and brings up in the movie. And just the idea that it's inevitable that these things reoccur.
Yeah.
In the movie in its final moments leans heavily into the fact that that is a known factor in this world. Yeah. And so I've really started to like think a lot about those stories and just kind of what the filmmakers tried to do with their sequels, because if I have to do that, that's what I'd want to kind of, I don't want to say spoof, but that's what I would want to get really meta with, you know, is this one really meta with just how to survive on these movies, but then getting really meta with how do you continue the story? So
is there a possible follow-up in the pipeline, or?
There is a possible one. So our festival run for the movie has been great. Uh-huh. We went to Fantastic Fest and Telluride Horror Show and Toronto After Dark. And we've been to, I've actually, this sounds like really cocky. I don't mean it like that. I've lost count of how many festivals we played at. So like, oh, you know, I'm just spoil of riches, just all these festivals. I can't keep track. That's not how I mean it. But we had some really great festivals, and we've had a lot of excitement kind of generating. Like, as we've played festivals, we've kind of been pursued by other festivals that want to include us and all this stuff. So it's been really nice. Like, I've been really, I consider ourselves very fortunate, because, you know, in filmmaking, I feel like you're a little bit more of a mad scientist where you're trying to concoct something without the guarantee that you've succeeded. Yeah. And so you, with movies, you know, you won't know what's, the audience will tell you whether you succeeded or not, because it's not actually up to you. Like, they're the ones that have to go consume this story, and they're the ones that have to be affected by everything that you intended to do, and they'll tell you whether you succeeded or failed. And, you know, the majority of the response to the movie has been far more positive than I could have hoped or expected.
I have to say, I mean, like, following on the New Horror Express Twitter feed, the audience reaction at Toronto After Dark and the Fantastic Fest and all the festivals seems to have been very good indeed.
Yeah, they've been really great. Like, I'm really grateful. And what's funny is, like, even the people that don't like the movie think you should go see it. Like, even people like, the movie isn't great. It has pacing issues, but Fran and Allison make it so much fun to watch, and it is really hilarious. It's just not the best, but you should definitely see it. Like, those are the negative reviews that we get. And I'm just kind of like, wow, like, this is really, really cool. So there's been a lot of great reaction. The distributors have been paying attention to that. We are getting, we're about to get a wide release, not in theaters, but on VOD and iTunes and DVD Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. Here very soon. I don't know what date this episode's actually playing, but by the end of 2018, like the last part of 2018, like, the movie will be accessible domestically and internationally in a really cool way. There's also some streaming announcements that I'm not allowed to make because it hasn't been announced yet, but there's some really big, really exciting, there's a really exciting streaming announcement coming out, which will be cool. So the movie will be accessible there too. So the movie's about to be out for everyone to see. Yeah, and now that the festival run is done, yeah, everyone's just basically just kind of standing back going, okay, well, we know the movie's like critically well received, the fans really like it, so let's see how it does as far as business. And if it does well as far as business, then we can talk about a sequel. I know that there's a lot of want internally for one. The question is, does it make sense on a business level to actually do it? I'm 50-50. Like, I'm really happy with the movie as it is. The idea of making a sequel feels more daunting than it feels exciting to me right now, mm-hmm. because I don't know what it is, but it would be a fun adventure to go down if we are invited to, so we'll see.
And do you have any other fires in the oven, or are you just kind of concentrating on wrapping up this festival tour?
Kind of both. You know, the festival tour has been really distracting the fire. Nothing that I can really talk about just yet. There's a couple movies that I'm writing that I'm really excited to do that kind of follow tonally in a similar air as You Might Be the Killer. And then there's, you know, it's like everyone's trying to reboot stuff. And so they try and like get my name involved with a couple of these upcoming reboots potentially, but nothing's been solidified yet. So I was like, I'd be a total like weirdo to like bring it up, but if it happens, then I'll just come back on the podcast. We can talk about it. But, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I'm really focused on these movies I'm trying to write next, which is the other reason why a sequel feels a little daunting. Cause I got a couple other movies like up my sleeve that I really want to make. So we'll see. I mean, hopefully maybe I'll have something that we can talk about soon.
Okay. That would be great. I know you're a very busy guy. I know you have to go away now. I'm sure we could talk for much longer about various horror topics, but I will let you go.
Thanks for having me back, Scott. It's been fun talking. Let's do it again.
Yeah, will do.
That was my guest, Brett Simmons there, who I'd like to thank once again for appearing on this episode of the show. And I think it's fair to say we shall see him return to complete this trilogy for an epic part three, whenever that may be, and whatever it may be about, whether it be about You Might Be the Killer part two or any other upcoming projects that he has that end up coming to fruition. We'll definitely hear from Brett again. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the show. As always, listener, thank you very much for tuning in. Remember, you can listen to all previous episodes of New Horror Express on iTunes and Stitcher, where you can rate, review, and subscribe. It would be incredible of you to give us a 5-star rating, leave us a review, give us your thoughts and comments. You can also like us on Facebook, give us a follow on Twitter. That's all for this episode. On the next episode, I'll be chatting to the Ranger director, Jen Wexler. But for now, see ya.